Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On this day next year, we will know the winner of the Iowa caucuses. That first test in the presidential election process is exactly a year from yesterday, but the race has already begun. Democrats appear to be assembling the largest presidential field in history. 10 people, if I'm counting correctly, are already running. They include some names that you've probably never heard of, like entrepreneur and spiritual guru Marianne Williamson, along with some heavy hitters like Senators Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, and Cory Booker, as well as various people in between. Former Vice President Joe Biden is considering getting in. So are two former New York City mayors, billionaire Mike Bloomberg and Bill de Blasio. Former Attorney General Eric Holder is kicking the possibility around, as is the former governor of Virginia, not the current one, Terry McAuliffe. And there are others, many, many others. And that's both good news and bad news. The good news, that there appears to be someone for everyone in that field. The bad news is that so far, 56% of Democratic voters have no preference at all. South Carolina's first in the South primary may reveal a lot about what African-American voters are thinking, and already a number of high-profile candidates have paid the Palmetto State a visit, and given the move toward Democrats that North Carolina voters took in the last election, the National Party is no doubt keeping a close eye on our state, too. So here to talk about the candidates, the race, and what they believe voters want are some party leaders from both states. Jane Whitley is chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party. She's in our Spirit Square studio along with Aisha Dew, a Democratic strategist, former first vice chair of the North Carolina Party, and the person who managed Bernie Sanders' 2016 North Carolina campaign. Welcome to you both. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Aisha. And with us by phone, Trav Robertson. He's the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Thank you for joining us, too.
It's a pleasure to be with you all this morning.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Get to search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch at least three of us on Facebook Live. You have to drive up from Columbia to be on Facebook Live, Trav. I'm sorry. Are any of you
I've got a face made for radio.
Okay. So do I. Are you any of you surprised by the number of people who have already declared at this stage of the game, Aisha?
Not at all. Jane. And I think it's great.
Jane?
I'm not surprised either. The Republicans had the same type of field last time around, and this time we're seeing the same thing on the Democratic side.
I don't remember, Trav, but if you polled Republicans at this time 2 or 3 years ago, would 56% of them had no preference?
Oh, I think so. Okay. There's no question about that. And you know, this is going to be an exciting time for South Carolina and North Carolina. We're about to get a lot of attention from a lot of people.
I spoke yesterday with Bob Woodward, who will be on this program tomorrow, and he mentioned that in almost every recent presidential election, the person who won the office at this stage of the game, you would not even have known their name. Bill Clinton.
Right.
Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, you would not think that he would have won the presidential election. So all these people who have declared, and some of them are pretty big names, I was going to ask, do the people who you don't know have a shot at this? Do they?
Absolutely. I mean, President Obama was at 6% going into the Iowa caucus at this time. So going into, 06, 07, right? Mm-hmm. So he had a year to make a difference, and he sat down and had conversations and talked to people, and then he came out a winner.
And what's interesting is when I'm talking to the national media and they say, well, who's got the advantage in South Carolina? I said, listen, it's wide open here. And the fact is that it's going to be a transformative election to the extent that, you know, South Carolina has 54.5% to 55.5% of the electorate are women. We may have anywhere from 2 to 4, 5 credible, well-funded female candidates that our electorate can choose from, and we're going to have two very well-funded African-American candidates that will campaign not at the African-American community, but in the African-American community. And so it's going to be an exciting election cycle here, and it's wide open. We're looking, and I think, you know, North Carolina is an example, too. We're looking for that candidate that's going to put a field organizer in every single county in South Carolina and create a grassroots organization that propels them to victory.
Jane, excuse me.
That's okay. I agree. We may be seeing a candidate that we haven't really paid that much attention to, but I do want to point out that the women in this race are so important. About 60% right. of the electorate in the primaries in 2016 in Mecklenburg were women. And, you know, that's what we're going to be looking for. What else is interesting is our primaries were March 15th in 2016, so it's only a few weeks earlier, but there's about a dozen states who are going to be having primaries. We're in Super Tuesday.
Right.
We're going to be right after South Carolina, which should be getting a lot of attention, and we're in the same media market. So we're going to be seeing a lot of that activity, and Mecklenburg's going to be extremely important.
Get ready to run from the TV set between in the commercial breaks.
That's right.
And if I'm not mistaken, y'all will be voting early in North Carolina, too. Well, before our primary actually occurs, is that correct?
That would be correct.
Okay. During the last campaign, the Republicans fielded an enormous group of candidates, and so big, in fact, that they had to have separate sets of debates because you couldn't put them all on the stage at the same time. And the debates went on forever. You kind of got voter fatigue. I mean, people got tired of watching them, and a star emerged as the result of those debates. What did you guys learn from that experience? Because you now have a large field of candidates. What did you learn from that, Jane?
Well, I understand that the Democratic Party is going to start with debates at the end of this year, and they're looking at some different ways to get all these people in there. What did we learn? I'll be honest, I couldn't quite make it through all of the Republican debates when they did this.
I'm not sure Republicans could.
I don't think so.
Because that's what I'm alluding to. The fact that you have so many candidates and you want to give them airtime, and the networks want to give them airtime, but then after you give them once a week, we have these candidate debates, which aren't really debates, which are more like horse races and soundbite quips. People just get tired of it. I mean, the candidates get tired, the moderators get tired, the viewers really get tired of this. I mean, is there a better way to do it?
There are other ways to reach voters other than the debates.
Yeah, you don't have to name names, but there's so many people in this. Are there people that you wish were not? Just yes or no?
No.
No, you want everybody to be in this thing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think that 2016 became very quickly polarized on our side because we had two really big name people. And I really like the fact that we kind of have a cast of all stars, people who've been elected to office, people who can be well funded, people who are already laying the groundwork in Iowa and doing the job. So I'm excited to have a group to pull from so that hopefully we can coalesce after it's all over.
Well, I mentioned the fact that 56%, according to the ABC News Washington Post recent poll, said that of Democratic voters said that if the election were held today, they have no preference. They're self-identified Democrats. Is that more troubling to you, Trav, than this fact that Joe Biden leads the field and he only has 9% preference among Democratic voters and he's the leader of the field?
No, that doesn't bother me at all. You know, I've told a lot of county party chairs and a lot of the activists here, I said, you know, you all are going to go on a lot of dates with these candidates. You don't necessarily have to get married after the first date. And the point being is that people have to make up their minds based on the issues that affect them, based on whether that's the economy, whether it's healthcare. And we're going to have such a large number of candidates, all of whom have a very unique message. They have a unique life story. They've got a unique perspective, and they're going to be candidates that offer a little bit of something to everybody. And that's going to make a choice a little bit harder. And I think that, you know, it's there was an article about 10 or 15 years ago in Newsweek or Time, and it equated the literacy rate in Iowa with the caucuses. And I think that every time we get an early presidential primary that is contested, whether it be a Republican primary or a Democratic primary, it really benefits the political IQ of the voters in South Carolina and North Carolina. And as a result of that, you see those individuals who may wait to make up their mind until they actually get a chance to touch a candidate or look at them eye to eye. And I think that's probably what you're seeing there.
Okay, because Biden, with 9% of the Democratic voters favoring him at the moment, is followed by California Senator Kamala Harris, 8%. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders, this should be hit near and dear to your heart, Aisha, since you managed his campaign, but Bernie Sanders is polling at 4%. You know who else is at 4% among Democratic voters?
Who?
Donald Trump. Elizabeth Warren is coming in at only 2%. Now these are early numbers, but mm-hmm. some Democratic stars are not polling very high. Does that concern you?
Some of them are polling higher and higher in Iowa.
Okay,
but which I told you doesn't mean anything.
I know, but does that concern you? Bernie Sanders, who almost won this thing, at 4%. Elizabeth Warren, who's been running, I think, since 1985, she's at 2%.
It's almost not surprising, right? Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders appeal to a lot of the same audience, right? And I think that in 2016, there was this very populist moment, and Bernie Sanders was the person who answered that particular call.
Should Bernie run again?
This is democracy.
Should Hillary run again? Because I've heard that if Bernie runs, she may consider it.
This is democracy.
But what's good for the party? You're party people. What's good for the party, Jane?
I'd actually like to see some new faces come out. I think Kamala Harris is an exciting candidate. Cory Booker just joined the party. Joe Biden may jump in. That's not a new face. We've got Beto O'Rourke, who hasn't announced what he's going to do. And with the Super Tuesday primary on March 3rd, we're in a group that includes a California primary and Texas primary. So that could be very, very interesting.
So there is no question that Democrats want to defeat Donald Trump. They would want to defeat the occupant of the White House, if it's a Republican, no matter who that person was. But they really want to defeat Donald Trump. Is that desire to beat President Trump enough to excite Democrats, hardcore Democrats, and left-leaning Democratic-leaning independents to come out and vote for your side?
Well, I think what we've seen in Mecklenburg County, and this has been happening across the country, but from my experience in Mecklenburg County, what we're seeing are women, especially in the suburbs, coming out and really getting organized. And this is happening all over, but I will say it's mostly women. We have organized precincts where we've never had precincts organized before. We just have... Yeah. Like so much energy and enthusiasm.
I only have about 30 seconds left here, Trav, but if a woman ends up being the Democratic nominee, do you think Nikki Haley will be on the ticket with Donald Trump?
Who knows? I never thought that I would see Donald Trump as president, so anything's possible. I think that you will see a significant or a real in-depth scrutiny of her past and some of her past business dealings, mm-hmm. and I think that the question is whether she could survive that scrutiny.
Trav Robertson is the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. He's here with us with Jane Whitley, the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party, and Aisha Dew with the party as well. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the future, the fortunes, the fate of the Democratic Party in the upcoming election in 2020 with Aisha Dew, Democratic strategist, former first vice chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party. Jane Whitley is here. She's the chair of the Mecklenburg County Party, Democratic Party, and Trav Robertson is the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. According to this ABC News Post, Washington Post poll, Democrats are divided on issues important to them and on the qualities that they want in a candidate. The poll shows that 47% of Democratic leaners say it is more important that the party nominate someone whose positions on issues are close to their own, while 43% say they prioritize finding a candidate most likely to defeat Donald Trump. Voters on both sides often have issue litmus tests for their party's candidates. And no matter how important they believe a White House victory is, they just won't vote for the front runner or for the nominee because that nominee, for whatever reason, doesn't pass the litmus test that they have set up for anybody they're going to vote for. Can Democrats afford that in this election? A lot of people wouldn't vote for Hillary because they were Bernie Sanders candidates, voters, and they just wouldn't cross over. That helped cost the election.
Well, I mean, I was always a Bernie person, not a Bernie or bust person, right? And so at the end of the day, we have to get behind the Democratic nominee. We don't have it to risk this time. So I think that, and I think and hope that this time around, people will really coalesce behind the nominee. And we have enough people to get behind for us to support and then come together after it's all done.
I'm sorry, I just disagree with you. I think that I know a lot of the folks who supported Bernie Sanders in the primary in South Carolina and they voted for the Democratic nominee. I think that the reason we lost that race was a clear lack of understanding as to whom the Republican opponent was. And at the end of the day, if you had taken that campaign and run it in Arkansas instead of, the Northeast, you might have seen what was coming. Most importantly, you might have been able to work around it. But I'm not going to lay our loss at the segment of a group of voters who supported Bernie Sanders. I think that there were folks who at the end of the day were drawn to him because he is authentic. It's like my mama said. She said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders, but I believe everything he says. And that's what people were looking for. But I'm not willing to say that the Bernie Sanders supporters cost us that election. I think that was a campaign mistake that fundamentally did not have the infrastructure in place to carry forward a winning campaign because they didn't understand what they were up against.
Okay. You certainly understand what you're up against now, Jane. You know we have 2 years of Donald Trump, three actually when you count the campaign into this. You know what he's about. You know what he stands for. You know who he appealed to in the last election. And many of the people who voted for him, who he appealed to, were traditional Democratic voters. How do you get them back?
Well, I actually agree with Trav. I did not see the Bernie supporters going away that much. There were some. There needs to be an infrastructure. I know that a lot of what I saw with the campaign in 2016, we weren't necessarily getting the people to the polls that we needed to get to the polls. So in order to get these folks back, we do need to appeal to traditional Democratic values. Everybody wants affordable care, health care. We need to concentrate on what we're doing and the infrastructure of the campaign to get folks to the polls.
What do North Carolina voters, Democratic voters and Democratic-leaning voters want, Aisha?
They want adequate health care. They want also a strong economy and jobs. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're going to be able to defeat Donald Trump. And that is that he is not delivering on the needs that people have. There has been some recent polling that shows there is dissatisfaction with the president in a way that there was dissatisfaction with the Republican Party in 06, 07 leading into 08. So I think for North Carolina, that puts us in a position to be able to really make a comeback, even in extremely difficult districts. And Jane and us as a party, like we did a really good job in Mecklenburg County of taking Republican seats that we've never had. We've been gerrymandered to a point that it makes it extremely difficult, but we were able to communicate with those voters and tell them why we resonated with them. And thanks, Trav, for supporting Bernie folks. Our 2 years of conversations have paid off.
So, Trav, what do South Carolina Democrats and Democratic-leaning voters want? What do they want?
I think that we're looking for someone who has an independent streak, someone who is delivering a message that resonates across all ethnicities and socioeconomic statuses. And but most importantly, I think people are looking for someone who is authentic. And I think you're going to have that in this slate of candidates. And they want someone who's real. And I think that that was one of the things that people clearly underestimated about Donald Trump. But for all of the things that we disagree or don't like about Donald Trump, there's a certain section of our populace and the electorate that believe that he is authentic, that he means what he says and says what he means. And we've got to have a candidate who comes across that way to voters as well.
Is South Carolina as gerrymandered as North Carolina is in favor of Republicans?
There's no question about it. I mean, there were seven seats in the General Assembly that we should have won. The candidates did everything correctly. And if there were another 5 to 10 or 15% of the black voting age population in those districts, we would have picked up the seat.
You mentioned...
I mean, Congressman Clyburn...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Congressman Clyburn's district is an example, is that he's got 18 counties in South Carolina. We only have 46. And if you were to put some of those counties into one or two other congressional districts, you've got swing districts.
So let's talk about authenticity, because all of you have mentioned authenticity, that Democrats want an authentic candidate, somebody who says what they mean and means what they say, like Donald Trump appears to be doing for most of his partisans. One of the things that Democrats have done in the last several years is run screaming from their attributes, the things that make them Democrats. The big L word, for instance. They refuse to say, we're liberal. Now you're progressive. Capital P. It's the same damn thing. But do you have to embrace the things that brought you to the party? And I don't mean the Democratic Party, but I mean the things that you've done over the course of your history as a party in the 20th century. Social Security, Medicare, the 40-hour work week, paid vacations, all of which stemmed from Democratic control of Congress and the White House. Those are things that people have come to expect out of America. Right. Can you run from them and be successful? Why don't you yell it from the rooftops?
I think the Republicans are the ones afraid of the L word these days. Look at what happened with the indivisible movement. People were showing up and saying, I need my health care. And some of these were Republicans who were saying this. Everybody needs the same things. We expect a good economy. We expect affordable health care. These are things that
Democrats except Republicans are excellent at framing the conversation, latching on to the key words in that conversation and hammering them home in lockstep. And you guys are like a pack of dogs. You just can't.
We're learning.
Well, are you? That's the question. Are you learning?
And I don't think that we have to be uniform and in lockstep. In 2016, my thought was that we as a party did not do a good job communicating, right? I thought that one of the reasons that Hillary Clinton suffered was that we as a party had not been carrying that mantle over the last 30 years. We forgot to talk about it. We forgot to communicate around it. And therefore, people didn't really know what we stood for. But I think that there is a critical crossroads now between definitely representing the issues and then the authenticity of the messenger and the person who's handling it. So on the same night the Vilaus won is the same night that we won the Virginia House of Delegates, right? Okay. And so by the time we finished in November, we realized that all of these people were sitting around kitchen counters around the country with their authentic message, their local issues, and they were winning up and down the ballot.
What does the Democratic message have to be, particularly in areas that are really Republican areas, such as South Carolina? What does the Democratic message have to be, Trav, to entice people to vote for you?
Well, I think that it's easier said than done, to the extent that We saw what Stacey Abrams in Georgia was able to accomplish. We've seen what the governor in North Carolina has been able to accomplish. And we saw what Gilliam was able to accomplish in Florida. And I think that what we've got to recognize is Lakoff's right, that we have to start focusing on not just what we say, but the words and how we say it. We have been very big failures at allowing Republicans to take what our perceived negatives are and turning them into chinks in our armor. And at the end of, and essentially allowing them to define us. And I think that you saw this last election cycle with candidates throughout the country who said enough is enough.
Does this
the fact is, I hate when Donald Trump's called a populist, because I always thought that Huey Long was a populist. And that was a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage. And it pains me that we've allowed populism to be co-opted by a president that's never known a suffering day in his life except for when he sprays too much tan on his face. The reality is that we have to make sure in South Carolina, we have people who die if they have a stroke or a heart attack in rural South Carolina in an ambulance because they can't get to a hospital. We have one of the, on the I-85 corridor between Atlanta and Charlotte, we've got BMW, we've got Michelin, we've got an international economy in Greenville, South Carolina. That hospital system had to merge with another hospital system because the governor won't expand Medicaid in this state. At the end of the day, people want a handful of things. They want to make sure they've got a good job. They want to make sure they can provide for their family. They want their kids to have access to education. They want to have access to health care and maybe have a week or 2 weeks off a year on a vacation to spend it with their family. That's essentially what people want. And we're looking for a president who tells us about the shining city on a hill, not one who actually says this is the worst that America has to offer.
So the messaging, it seems to me, if I were a Democratic operative, the messaging for me would have to begin tomorrow night. It would have to begin with Stacey Abrams, who you just mentioned. She's delivering the Democratic response to the State of the Union message. It seems to me that whatever she says is all important. She's going to set the tone for the Democrats, for the race ahead. Is she the right person to do that? And what do Democrats behind the scene tell her? How does that work? What are they feeding her in terms of what she's going to say tomorrow night?
Well, Stacey Abrams is right. We have to have this right to vote. And we're seeing this in North Carolina right now in the 9th District race, mm-hmm. which is coming up, well, we'll see what happens, but chances are that we may have a new election coming up very soon. The fact that someone was out there stealing votes in North Carolina and may have been doing this for years is...
On both sides. On both sides. The guy that's been accused of this works for Democrats and Republicans.
Okay. I don't know him. And he was stealing votes from Democrats.
Allegedly. Okay.
Yes. but this, at any rate, no matter who does it, it is voter suppression. And the things that she's bringing out are very important.
But what does she have to say to it? Because only people in North and South Carolina really understand this vote stealing thing, and maybe even gerrymandering to a certain degree. What does she have to say to light the fire under people? Because this is a popular president among people who voted for him. And he can't win with just that he can't win with just that coalition, but you've got to say something that makes people wake up and take notice, or you're dead in the water.
Well, the fact is I think that there are two things at play here, Mike. One is that it is a historical fact that we're having an African American female
absolutely
return the state of the state to a Republican president who has demonstrated a lack of caring and understanding of the African-American community. But most importantly, I think it sends a message to women, specifically in South Carolina, where a significant number of voters in our primary will be African-American females. And like I said earlier, 54.5% to 55.5% of the electorate in this state is female. And we're going to have to start communicating better with female voters, plain and simple. And this is a beginning, but I think that part of this is to show that we have a future in the Democratic Party. But she's going to have to talk about some of the things. She's going to have to talk about health care in rural South and rural America. She's going to have to talk about an economy that doesn't work for everybody. You know, just 15 years ago, the Wall Street Journal ran an article that South Carolina was essentially recession-proof. Well, you know, that may very well have been true, but it sure didn't feel that way when you get down to the PD and parts of the Low Country where you couldn't find a job or there was no way to retrain and re-educate people to fill some of the jobs that we have available. So she's going to have to talk about that. She's going to have to talk about the future of this country and, most importantly, how we move from being a divided country into a country that comes together.
And even not only is the country divided, but Democrats have traditionally, at least in recent years, been divided. Michael emails, the Democrats divided in 2016 between progressives and the establishment and never came together. In turn, Trump is president. Are the two parts back together now? They don't seem to be. That's according to our emailer.
I think we are back together. I think we're coming together. And there's going to be a lot of work to do for whoever is the head of the ticket. And I don't think that anyone will take that for granted. And I just want to circle back to Stacey Abrams. It is powerful, and it sends a message to have an African-American woman from the South. When you look at the Southern Caucus, Trav and I had this experience at the DNC. We were the only caucus that was happy because we won Alabama, and then we won North Carolina, and we had standout candidates in Georgia and in Florida. The South is at play. You cannot win president of the United States without winning African Americans in the South, and we are poised to do it.
Well, the Boston Globe says that South Carolina is increasingly seen as the primary state that picks Democratic presidents. They don't mention us, but they mention South Carolina. We'll come back and talk about that and some other things as well with our three Democratic operatives here, apparatchiks, on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins here with Jane Whitley, the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party, Aisha Dhu, Democratic strategist, former vice chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party, and Trav Robertson, who joins us by phone. He's the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. I just mentioned that the Boston Globe calls to South Carolina the primary state that picks Democratic presidents at a rally in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King on the steps of the State House in Columbia. The city's mayor down there said the road to the White House starts in South Carolina. And that is why Bernie Sanders and Cory Booker were there to speak. Some say that South Carolina is that gateway to the nomination. I know you agree with that, Trav. Why?
Of course I agree with it. I think that when you take South Carolina, it not only has a diverse electorate when you compare it to Iowa and New Hampshire, but most importantly, it's cheaper to campaign here. And that's one of the things that we seem to gloss over at times. It not only educates our citizens in North and South Carolina, but most importantly, it's cheaper for campaigns to buy television, to put staff on the ground, to put ads on the radio, to do a cross-digital communication program.
Well, it is true that the television market in Charleston and the television market in Columbia, and to a certain degree the television market in the Greenville, Spartanburg, Asheville area is cheaper, but Amy on Facebook wants to know, I wonder if y'all, that's her word, y'all, could ask Trav to say a few things about how candidates should approach the part of South Carolina that falls in the Charlotte metro area and the Charlotte media market, because we are more expensive.
Right. Well, I mean, I say this because I'm an accidental party chair. I spent most of my life running campaigns. I think that along that, and you'll have to forgive me, the dog is barking.
It's a blue dog, right?
Yes, okay. It is. All right. And what I would suggest to them is what I call a cross-device digital communications program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you can do that all along the North Carolina, South Carolina border. And you also would have to start using cable instead of some of the Charlotte media and whatnot. So you've got individual cable markets there, but there's no question that texting and digital, and I'm not talking about just Facebook ads, I'm talking about IP addresses and communicating that way to individuals.
Yeah. You're losing our audience. They have no idea what you're talking about. compare our state, compare North Carolina to South Carolina in terms of importance, and has that importance changed with the fact that we are one of those Super Tuesday states in the upcoming elections?
I think the importance has, we're going to be more important, having been moved up a little bit. Although last year we were in March, that was a little bit earlier than in the past. But one thing about the dozen or so states that are going to be on Super Tuesday, Texas and California are going to be big, but North Carolina is also going to be important too, partly because it's right beside of South Carolina, and there's a they get a little bit of a twofer by advertising right. on North Carolina and Charlotte stations.
And because the Charlotte stations leak into South Carolina,
exactly.
And vice versa.
Yep.
Well, we really split three markets with North Carolina. You've got the ABC affiliate in the upstate in the Asheville mm-hmm. market. You've got the Charlotte market, and then you've got Wilmington. And I think Wilmington's share of that market has shrunk just a little bit, but there's a lot of bleed over, and then you've got a lot of radio too.
Right. So in the midterms, we witnessed what could I guess be called a generational changing of the guard among Democrats, and maybe even a gender changing of the guard among Democrats, with a pink wave that swept a lot of women into the House of Representatives. This all followed Hillary Clinton's presidential bid, and a lot of Democrats were not excited about her. She would have been a first in terms of a woman in the White House, but she seemed to represent the old guard. Is there anybody like that in the field of candidates now, or are they pretty much looking forward to the future, and have they learned that they need to speak to this changing of the guard, even if it's Joe Biden?
That's interesting. I think that Joe Biden fits in a bizarre sort
of
crossroads.
Kind of does.
In the sense that he could be looked at as a changing of the guard because he wasn't a part of the 2016 field. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he is also a somewhat of an institutional candidate. I will say that even though Hillary Clinton didn't win, I think four out of five U.S. Senate seats were women of color in 2016, which I think set the precedent for what's now continued to happen. In 2017 and 2018.
But Donald Trump was elected largely because people wanted to return to something old, something comfortable. They wanted to make something again. They didn't want to move forward. They wanted to move backward. And in part, that was probably a backlash against our first African-American president. But it had also to do with they want to return to the middle class that people lived through in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Which is completely ironic, Mike, because you saw the largest expansion of the middle class under Bill Clinton's presidency. And I also think that, quite frankly, and this is what we've got to be very careful about, we allowed them to define Hillary Clinton over 40 years. And as a party chairman, I allowed that to happen too.
So how do you stop it? Because it's going to happen again. So how do you stop it?
Exactly,
how do you define it? How do you take control?
I think you're going to see, I think you hit the nail on the head. We've got to make sure that we've got Stacey Abrams back tomorrow night. And that we're on social media, online. And I think that at the end of the day, we've got to make sure that people on our side take to social media, to any medium we have available, and defend her. Nancy Pelosi, she just showed Donald Trump how to negotiate. And at the end of the day, you know, I sent an email to the DNC the other day. I said, you know, there might have been an expletive in front of it, but I said, y'all are losing. Y'all need to be defending Nancy Pelosi. Because we we do not want to allow what occurred to Hillary Clinton over the last 40 years, because at the end of the day, I don't like to put us in a progressive box. I don't like to put us in an old guard box. You know, everybody has a unique story. Whether you want to, whether you campaign for Hillary or not, she was the most qualified person to run for president of the United States in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference if she was a woman or a man. She was the most qualified person to run for president in my lifetime.
And we have to continue.
If we had that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Trav, we also have to continue to call out and rename and define the conversation.
That's right.
We should not allow all of these women to be treated differently than all of the other male candidates.
That's right.
And early on, people did not have that conversation, and it was only in terms of Hillary Clinton.
Will Donald Trump
now
have
it's
to
in
treat,
terms of everyone.
If your nominee is a woman, of any of these women who are running right now or those who might enter the race in the future, if Donald Trump is the Republican candidate, will he have to treat them differently on the campaign trail?
It would be nice to think that. I highly doubt it. So that means that we have to call it out, name
but,
it, and
but
lift it up.
If he doesn't treat them differently, or if he doesn't treat them with, say, less more respect than perhaps he treated Hillary Clinton, will there be a backlash this time?
That's what I hope.
You know, it's interesting. Go ahead, Aisha. I'm sorry.
Trav, all I said is that's what I hope. Go ahead, Trav.
it's exactly interesting that if you remember when Joe Biden debated Palin, everybody was talking about how he had to use kid gloves. He had to be very careful how he did it. It was tricky. But no one holds Donald Trump to that same standard.
Hmm. Okay.
And at the end of the day, we allowed that to happen.
Very quickly here, Nelson emails something that probably you need to hear about. I'm a senior and an independent, he says. The Democratic Party has moved so far to the left that I cannot vote for anyone with a D behind their name. I am not in love with Donald Trump or any other Republican, but the Republican Party does not scare me as much as socialism. You're going to get that thrown in your. You're going to get that thrown in your face a lot. So, how do you defend that?
Well, you know, I went the other day and I spoke to a group of businessmen, and I looked at him and you know, I was there with my counterpart, the chair of the state Republican Party, and he talked about the anti-business socialist Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me tell you something. First and foremost, I don't remember any of these pro-business Democratic Republicans standing up to defend BMW or Michelin or the German automotive industry when Donald Trump attacked them at this G8 summit. I don't remember any of these pro-business people standing up defending a Samsung and Element TV who were talking about shutting down and not investing in South Carolina because of the tariff war that this pro-business Republican president created. And anybody who believes that we as Democrats are socialists, you've never been to a socialist country. So at the end of the day, that's you trying to place a narrative on us. The truth is, if you want access to health care, if you want to make sure you've got a quality education, and you want to make sure you've got a job opportunity when you graduate from either high school or college, then you might need to consider what real socialism is as opposed to the democratic principles.
But there are people calling for universal compensation. In other words, everybody gets a salary. People are calling for it right now.
Well, I don't know that I've ever heard that. I think that everybody's calling for a minimum wage increase, which proves that it benefits the middle class in this country. I don't believe I've heard anybody, and maybe I'm just not listening, but I don't recall any presidential candidate saying a universal salary for every person.
Well, here's a phrase that all of you...
Talk about health care, Mike. We've already got Medicare and Medicaid.
Okay. And people like it. People like it.
That's exactly right. Okay. People like it. People need it. We've got an elderly... This is the first time in the history of the United States of America that five separate generations are alive at the same time. They not only consume data and knowledge differently, their healthcare needs are different too.
Right.
And the younger generation, Go ahead, Aisha.
When you call it affordable care and not Obamacare, all of a sudden people don't want their health care to be taken away. So there is a perception that is not based in reality. And you have one of the pro-business city councils that we have, and they happen to be Democratic.
It's the control of the language, the control of the terms that Republicans have been very good at.
Absolutely.
Here's a phrase that we've all heard a lot in recent years, that this is the most consequential or important election of our lifetimes. Has that phrase worn out its effectiveness, or does it still resonate with partisans on both sides?
2016 was possibly the most consequential. but this is even more consequential. This is a big one.
Better or worse.
Yeah.
Let me throw out an idea here, because Vice President Biden, at the moment, leads the Democrats in terms of people liking any individual in the race. He has 9% of people who are Democrats or leaning Democratic, and he's a throwback to an earlier time and a guy who maybe should have run 4 years ago, but I guess he saw that it was Hillary's turn. He's already 76.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if he were to run in this race, would it be to his best interest, would it be to your party's best interest to have him say, okay, I'm in, and I'm going to bring with me Kamala Harris or somebody else, Beto O'Rourke, as my vice president, but I'm only going to do this for one term? People like Joe Biden. Would you guys see this as an opportunity to put somebody in the race who might beat Donald Trump and then expose a younger person for the next 8 years?
That's a possibility.
As a chairman, I'm not going to box the former vice president in like that. He can do whatever he so chooses. That's his prerogative. I mean, you know, people are always looking at some type of a shtick or a cute thing to make them different than everybody else. The question then becomes, or the media, let's say he does it, then the media turns on him and says there's no point in electing him because he'd be a lame duck as soon as he got elected. Mm. I'm not willing to put him in a box. The fact is that people in this country are living longer. My mom and dad are both 82, and at the end of the day, just because someone is 76 doesn't mean they can't be a productive citizen in our country.
Okay.
Absolutely.
There's another Democrat that we haven't mentioned who says that he will shed his Democratic skin if he gets into the race, and that's former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. He says he might run as an independent, although since he made that announcement a Sunday ago, he has been vilified by Democrats across the country and is now rethinking perhaps running because he's going to run as an independent. What would that do to your chances?
I think it would split the votes.
On the Democratic side?
Well, it
only?
Could split. Possibly not.
Because he's a billionaire businessman just like the president.
He has a lot of money.
Well, my question is, I'd like for Nelson, if you're still listening, I'd like Nelson to respond to that. Is that he's the independent. He doesn't like the Democrats. He's not thrilled with the Republicans. Is that somebody that a Nelson would support?
All I can say is good luck running as an independent.
Well, they've never won, and the system is not set up to allow an independent to run. And it makes you wonder why he's so critical of the Democratic Party. Why is he so critical of the Democratic Party? Why is he running as an independent? Just jump in. You don't know.
I can't call it.
Why is
the independents, the Green Party, like they've not won elections. So for President of the United States is not the place to start.
Well, stay tuned. We'll be talking about this for 2 years or more. Probably beginning tomorrow night with a response to the State of the Union. Trav Robertson joined us from South Carolina, the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Aisha Dew with the North Carolina Democratic Party. And Jane Whitley, chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party. Thank you all. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.